So welcome back from Thanksgiving. Hopefully you had a good one. Lecture 25, November 28th. Lecture notes, page 228. Still collecting food for needy animals. This is our class scheduled for the rest of the semester. I'm running behind. I've spent too much time here and there on business in the news and marketing in the news, so I hope we get to the fourth P of marketing, which is promotion, I hope. So somebody said I can just talk faster. I don't know if that's possible. Anyhow, there's the remaining days. We'll see how we do it. You know the major test 12 opened before Thanksgiving, and it will close Thursday out of respect for Thanksgiving, and then 13 will open Thursday as well, December 1st. Enhanced Earning Extra Credit and PACBACK will also close Wednesday evening on the usual schedule. So we're keeping it to business in the news. We're going to skip marketing the news for the time being. Inflation looms large as Black Friday shoppers head to the stores. How many of you guys got out on Friday for a little Black Friday shopping? Not that many. How many of you guys went out on Saturday to support small businesses in your area? Nobody cares. How many got online and bought shit, something? Okay, everybody else. All right, so Black Friday, the unofficial shopping holiday that's either a boon or a burden, depending on whom you ask, is again facing another test on its winding path to securing Americans' affection. So this is, of course, retailing. 2 years ago, fears of catching coronavirus kept many shoppers out of stores. Last year's, consumers bought early for fear of not getting what they needed, and amid supply chain clogs, which is what we're talking about now, distribution, impact of COVID. And this year, yet another global phenomenon is looming large, inflation. So the impact of one of those external factors, the CREST factors, economics, on businesses and consumers. A survey from the National Retail Federation found that the number of shoppers who say the economy is having a big impact on their holiday plans reached 60%, the highest level since the Great Recession of 2008-2009. So a bit of research. But even while shifting priorities, consumers' buying habits have remained resilient. We're understanding consumer behavior. A record 166.3 million shoppers are expected to hit the stores from Thanksgiving Day through Cyber Monday. Today, how many of you guys are engaging in buying something digital for Cyber Monday? Couple. Almost 8 million more than when they began tracking the data in 2017. The average shopper still plans to spend more than $800 on everything from gifts to decorations, so a bit about demand. Many report they'll be more selective in what they buy, in many cases trading down for cheaper goods and less expensive stores. Again, that would be part of retail. Consumers want better prices, so they're waiting on the sidelines. Shoppers are also increasingly dipping into their savings for holiday purchases, turning more to buy now, pay later services, such as Afterpay, that offer users installment plans, so the impact on consumers. And by the way, so many consumers are shifting to this idea of buy now, pay later. We're hoping that that next recession doesn't hit them hard with unemployment, because they're going to be scrawled if that happens. So hopefully they're planning ahead. Many are also running up their credit cards, same story, at a time when Federal Reserve is hiking rates to cool the U.S. economy. Credit card balances overall are at the highest they've been in 20 years. So all of this is impacting the consumers and how they're spending and how they're financing all this stuff. So fingers crossed for them. Picking up from last week, lecture notes page 228, page 417 in the textbook, with our continued discussion of channels of distribution and logistics and supply chain stuff. So we're trying to understand what this is all about. And here's the idea of the supply chain activities going all the way back to raw materials, where everything starts, right? And all that has to work okay. Yes, ma'am. The guy that I skipped? Yep, we're just going to skip him for now. We're going to flip the next page. Skip over him.
Are we going to go back to
him? Not now. So we're a page ahead, or two. Yeah, so we missed out for the time being on when our good friend over at the Soil and Manure Company said. So it goes all the way back to raw materials. All those raw materials get into all of our supplier networks in a timely fashion when they need it, so they can build the stuff that we need to make whatever it is we need in our manufacturing enterprising. So suppliers have to be sourced. All these things have to happen. Logistics has to ship stuff out to our distribution network, whether that's wholesalers, retailers, or I guess directly to the end consumer, that would all be part of the supply chain activities. So if we look at it in terms of logistics management and supply chain management, we would say that logistics refers to the idea of the flow of materials and parts, the flow from suppliers to producers, and the flow from producers to consumers. That's the idea of getting things going, trains and boats and planes and barges, whatever you ship stuff on, and making the whole system work together is what supply chain management is about. So here we have working the supplier network, making sure information flows, making sure we know what we're doing, stuff shows up what it's supposed to, and then we see the marketing channel from the producer out to the ultimate consumer, and all of that taken together is supply chain management, including overlaying boats, trains, buses, getting things shipped. We good? It's no longer good enough to have good relationships with just those individual suppliers. We've already talked about the fact that we need to communicate with an entire network of suppliers who need to coordinate their own activities related to our firm. This calls heavily on back office information systems. Where my CIS people, CS people, we had some here sometime, yeah. That's what I need you to do and get me this information. Otherwise, none of this works. I don't know what's going on. I'm in the dark. So for this is an example for cars. Here's the raw material for a car, steel, aluminum, rubber, and everything else that goes into it. These component parts come together to make things in our supplier network, like transmissions and brakes and seats. And those pieces and parts go together in the supplier network to make subassemblies like suspensions and chassis and engine. All of that eventually gets out to our auto manufacturers, the producer. Then the product gets out to the marketing channel and then out to the ultimate consumer. So here we have the idea of the activities involved in a automobile supply chain. So again, there's the supply chain management issue. So it can be a bit of a challenge to align our supply chain priorities with our marketing strategy, because in real life, our supply chain team may focus on their own short-term operational results. We've said before, if you ever worked on a team or managed a team, you know how hard it can be to just get a group of people all on the same page doing the same thing. Now we're talking about teams of people across multiple organizations and hoping that nobody sub-optimizes to do just their thing. Good luck with that. So a focus on short-term costs and short-term and their inventory doesn't produce the intended positive profit results for everybody in the chain, which is why we say we want to manage our supply chain effectively. So let's imagine a situation where we have three sorts of things that we're focused on as a supply chain. Customer needs, you would hope that would be important, yes? Customer needs. But also you have to recognize that the operations people are concerned about efficiency. What would all producers love to do? Have infinitely long runs of a single product, single size, single shape, no changeovers, no color changes, no different sizes. That's efficient. But of course, how's the real world work? No, you got to stop, make a different model, make a different color, make something special. Not efficient. They don't like that. And then asset utilization, of course, we're going to pop over to that. So customer needs ought to be the focus of our marketing efforts and of the firm. Efficiencies are an important cost-related focus to reduce our transportation costs, our inventory costs, our production costs. If you do it right, you align it with the customer's needs. And the idea of asset utilization is the idea of getting the most out of our production facilities, our capital investments, our plant, our equipment, our people. All of these things are expensive, and you want to utilize them well. And there's somebody over there saying, wait a minute, I want to utilize our plant better. We've got to get better use out of our people, whatever. Are these guys all working towards the goal of your customer's needs? So let's say our supply chain focuses on efficiency. They're going to focus on the lowest procurement cost, the lowest cost to buy the materials that they need. They're going to focus on highest plant utilization to be effective, efficient, and holding the lowest inventories. On their own, does that seem like stupid ideas? Does it seem like really dumb stuff? Low procurement costs, good plant utilization, low inventory costs. You would say, on the surface, that seems okay. But our customer wants high-quality products. Are you going to get high quality products if you're buying things at the lowest possible cost? Maybe not. They want innovation. If you're holding low inventories and long runs of things, are you going to be innovative? Probably not. They want a broad product line. Again, it doesn't sync up with this idea of high plant utilization, long runs of the same thing. We have a gap, a disconnect between the two. Our supply chain isn't doing what our customer needs. How's that going to work out for you? Probably not very well. So, if our customer wants high quality products, innovation, and broad product line, what do we need to focus on in our supply chain? Well, high supplier quality, not lowest cost. Shortest time to market to allow us to innovate and get things out. They want a broad product line because we have to keep changing over our manufacturing line to different things, so we have to focus on getting the shortest manufacturing changeover times to be efficient. You see how we now begin to close the gap between what our supply chain is doing and what our customers want? That's the sort of thing we have to think about as we think about the supply chain, their goals and objectives, and what our consumers want. I see pens are busy, so I'm going to take a breath. Maybe I'll take a sip. Oops, that was not the way to do that. We good? One day I have to pay attention to see what I have in my notes. I never know what's open, what has to be written. We good? Okay. So how are we going to cure the problem? Well, first of all, we have to start with the idea I think I mentioned before of the consumer, their needs, wants, and desires. And then we have to ask ourselves, how important, what value do our consumers put on? Lead time, for example, or quick response, for example, or efficient responses to their needs, for example, or the dependability of the shipment, or communication, or convenience. What is it that they value? And those are things you're going to try to align your supply chain to match, to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires of your consumer. So, to do this, we have to understand our supply chain and its strengths and weaknesses, and then harmonize that supply chain strengths with our marketing strategies. And sometimes you're going to find your partners aren't going to work with you. They're not going to do it. You may actually have to redesign that supply chain to make it work for you and your customer. I mentioned a minute ago, none of this works without my behind-the-scenes information flow. Electronic data interchanges, these combine proprietary computer and telecommunication technologies to exchange electronic invoices, payments, information, along that whole supply chain from suppliers to manufacturers to retailers. Saying it is really easy. His job is really hard, making it happen. Behind the scenes, reliably for all our channel partners. So, here we have a customer coming in. In the B2B world, it's called a tender requirement. It's like asking for a bid based on specifications. I got to know the bid came in. Thank you. I got to know what the bid is, what the questions are. Thank you. I got to make sure my entire organization knows what's going on so they can respond to the bid. Can we do it? What price can we do that? Thank you. And eventually, then, we decide if we are going to be able to bid and negotiate based on the information provided to us. Okay? So we finally bid and negotiate the contract. All that information has to flow to everybody so they know what's going on. And now we get an order. So now, with the order, we have to think about, can we do it? So we process the order. Do we have it in inventory? So yes, tell inventory to ship it out. Tell the warehouse to ship it out. Get it on a truck. Get it out there to the consumer. Make sure we know that the consumer got it. When any of that breaks down, we have a problem. By the way, we don't always have it available in store or in the shop, right? So what do we have to do? We have to make sure that we're able to make it. So what do we do to make it? Well, we have to schedule it, get the production done. Somebody has to tell our customer how it's going. It's work in process. It'll be there in 2 hours or 2 days or 2 weeks. Get it out, put it in inventory, warehouse, transportation, and out. Sometimes, of course, we don't have what we need to make the thing at all. So now we have to go out and get to our suppliers, and the whole process continues. We have to go to our suppliers and say, hey guys, give us these component parts. They have to figure the whole thing out themselves. They have to get it dispatched. They have to get it to us. We have to receive it. We have to know where it is. Did you get me that information in a timely fashion so I know what's going on? Comes to me in my inventory. and eventually I get it shipped out to the consumer. Did the consumer get it? By the way, did my training people know? They got it. They're ready for training or preparation of the site. We track on how they use it. We see whether or not they need any repair from pieces and parts. We see if they need any maintenance. Data, 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 data. And finally, we get to the stage of removal and replacement. So this whole thing, I just said we have to track it all with information. Easily said, pretty hard to make happen in an effective way so everybody knows what's going on. A friend of mine ran an optical supply plant for glasses. And he'd have these individual opticians who had customers. And they'd have special needs, not something you can do in a day. And so they bring in the special glasses, and they'd do the special grinding. They'd have special frames that they would have to get done. And the clients want to know from the optician, where is this thing? When it's ready? And he would have to have an entire tracking system, of course, by patient, by optician, by tray, by glasses, by frames. Where is it in the system? When's it being shipped? People want to know. So we not only need information to manage the supply chain, but to allow us to balance the total cost of our logistics efforts with the value that we provide to our customers. What do they value? Are we paying attention to what they value? How much does it cost? Are we pricing it right based on what they value? More data to make all these decisions. For example, anybody know Eaton, the company Eaton, Fortune 500 company located locally? Yeah, you know that. So Eaton, the following tools are available to distributors under our e-commerce umbrella, our order center, global digital solution for your e-commerce needs, shop, find real-time inventory and pricing, bulk load products to the cart, monitor order delivery status, review order history with just a few clicks. Thank you. You're providing this for us. We provide it to our clients. They know what's going on. If this sounds interesting, we have an entire course on supply chain management over in the Management Information Systems area, MNIS 44062, where they'll go into a lot more depth on this element, which we consider part of the four P's of marketing place. Continuing getting this product out to the ultimate consumer, something you're familiar with, certainly. We take it over to the idea of retailing and wholesaling, Chapter 16, Lecture Notes, page 234. So place is an element in the marketing mix. We've got product, price, promotion. We're talking about place. And here we're talking about the consumer at the middle because we're talking about retailing. Where is retailing headed? Well, the pandemic has certainly been rewriting the rules of retail. We'll have to see if it returns to normal anytime soon, but retailers need to stop expecting business to return to, quote, normal. This article says there's no going back to how it was anytime soon. Research suggests that consumers are likely to keep the behaviors they've adopted amid stay-at-home orders, such as more online shopping and fewer mall visits. Again, we didn't get much attention to shopping. Anybody go out to a mall over the last, over the holiday? Anybody went to a mall at all? Not one person, two people, three people, four people. Oh, now we're getting there. We went out, you guys know Easton Mall in Columbus? Yeah, we went out to Easton Mall. It was with my wife, so we went to Nordstrom's. And it wasn't all that crowded. I mean, there were people there, but it wasn't over masses of people. Retailers need to reimagine their baseline requirements and then turn their attention to taking their customer experience to the next level. Retailers have to adapt their bricks and mortar operations to comply with health and safety regulations and meet basic customer expectations. So obviously I'll have to change this slide probably for next semester, but at the time this included retailers having to adapt to mask wearing. I did still see people wearing masks at the mall. Ensuring physical distancing, controlling the number of employees and customers in stores, instituting contactless transactions, improving the speed of service, and introducing more self-service options because that's what consumers wanted, especially during the pandemic. Retailers also need to offer a simple and seamless e-commerce experience from browsing to researching to selecting to purchasing to return and exchange. Not that it's that big a deal, but over the weekend I needed some ink for my Hewlett-Packard printer that we talked about earlier. And I had some other work to do for this class, maybe. And so I didn't feel like going out, looking for in the store, finding the store, checking out the store. Went on the website, bada-bing, bada-boop, ordered up the Staples ink for the printer. An hour later, they said it was ready. I picked it up and walked out the door. It's seamless from the online search to the pickup to walking out the store. Payment's done. subpar digital shopping will no longer be acceptable to consumers. For a few retailers, Shake Shack Burgers, Nike Shoe Drops, or the latest Apple release, customers will still venture out to a bricks and mortar location, but that's no longer a strategy to rely on, as you see in the masses. You guys didn't go out shopping. Recently, many retailers have been putting as much, if not more, priority on the in-store experience than on the products that they sell as they rethink that in-person experience. As a result of COVID-19, all retailers have to make their in-store experiences even more extraordinary for those who can visit in person. I was stunned to find in the middle of Nordstrom at East, at what did I just say, East something, wherever it was, at the mall, they had a coffee and wine bar sort of freestanding right there in the middle of the store, and they have a whole store license. You can get beer and wine and wander around the store shopping as long as you're inside the store. That's somewhat new for a department store, as far as I know anyhow. It makes the experience interesting. So they give people a reason to visit. So compelling, it justifies their exposure in the pandemic to health risks and overcomes the inertia of behaviors they've adopted during the shutdown. Offer an exclusive, superior experience like luxury cinemas once did. Elevate the in-person customer experience. For example, Best Buy has done really well at this, and they have free in-home consultation services to make people want to buy their products. Digitally native customer experience. Many retailers with roots in bricks and mortar simply try to replicate their in-store experience online. That's not going to work. Customers don't expect a virtual experience to be like an in-person one, nor do they want it to be. So as a retailer, especially into the future, you have to invest in some of the unique capabilities of digital, real-time inventory management. When I went to look up that ink supply, it told me how many were there. Predictive analytics, AI-powered search, personalization, co-creation functions with the consumer. You have to work on social commerce, enabling companies to sell through social media channels and incorporating social interactions, peer support, reviews, recommendations, multimedia content, personalization, gamification, and more. So it's not enough just to say, hey, whatever they had a counter and they had a service salesperson and that was it. Let's do that online. No, consumers want and expect more from those retailers. This is something that was going on before the pandemic. Let's see if we can get this guy up and running. As folks were working on retail.
I should say the death of the store has been greatly exaggerated. There'll be a transformation of retail real estate, but not an end to it. You could step back and connect dots and say the world's going to have e-commerce only and that stores are dead, but we don't see that future at all, in part because I don't think consumers want that future. I think people like to shop and they like the serendipity of stores. And shopping is as much about entertainment and engagement as it is about utility. I think stores are going to become as much distribution and fulfillment centers as they are full-fledged shopping experiences. I think that stores and malls are going to be highly technology-enabled. Think of today, the square footage in a store needs to attract people in the door. It needs to have the right inventory at the right time, and it needs to have high service levels. That's a very expensive model, and it's a very inefficient model. What e-commerce has shown is that, particularly down the tail, it's much better business model to be just in time. And I think that there's a pattern in there for the way stores will transform. They'll become technology-enabled so that you can go to a store and see enough inventory, but you may shop shoppable windows. We're building those right now for retailers around the world. So I think that there are going to be stores, and I think that retail real estate is not dead, but it is going to transform, and it's going to happen faster than people think.
So I don't need to have all the sizes and all the colors and all the shapes in my store for you to have right now. Shoppable window, you see the basic idea. You try it in purple, blue, yellow, pink. And the window that shows you what you look like in these different colors, and then it ships to you from their central warehouse somewhere. More efficient approach to what's going on. Rebecca Minkoff's high-tech Melrose Place was using these ideas before the pandemic. as she developed. Let's see, is that a... So her high-tech Melrose shop is the shop of future retail, and she's got this idea of all these shoppable windows in place. Here's a shoppable window. You can see the item, but you can check it out in different sizes, different shapes, different colors, whatever it is they're running there. And in action at H&M in New York City, again, pre-pandemic, here's what it looked like.
Hello, I'm the H&M Voice Interactive Mirror. You can find me in the biggest H&M store in the world, on the second floor at Times Square, where I live and breathe fashion.
Hello from New York. I am at H&M Times Square store, and I'm here today to introduce you the Voice Interactive Mirror, unique in the world. Follow me. Get closer, get closer.
Get closer.
Hello, I'm a voice assistant. What would you like to do? Take a selfie or get fashion inspirations?
Selfie.
Are you ready?
Yes.
3, 2, 1, look up at the camera.
Which one do you like?
Oh, that's cool.
And now we are going to test the voice interactive mirror.
Hello, I'm a voice assistant. What would you like to do? Take a selfie or get fashion inspirations?
Take a selfie.
Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
3, 2, 1, look up at the camera. Which cover do you prefer?
Fashion.
I'm uploading it for you now. Great cover. Use a QR code scanner to download it. If you have an iPhone, open your camera to scan the code.
I got the link. The picture is gonna upload here. There you go. I have the cover in high resolution. If I scroll down, I will see the suggested hashtag. And if I subscribe to the fashion newsletter, I will get 20% discount in my next purchase.
Let's take a look at some fashion inspirations. What would you like to do? Take a selfie or get fashion inspirations?
Fashion inspirations.
Would you like to see women's or men's fashion?
Men fashion.
Great. What men's style would you prefer?
Modern classics.
Here's a modern classics look we think you'll like. Use a QR code scanner to shop the look or get 20% off. If you have an iPhone, open your camera to scan the code.
Now I'm gonna scan the QR code to get the fashion look recommendation. Here we go. This is a suggestion. I get 20% discount off if I subscribe to the fashion newsletter. And of course, I can go directly and get this look in our e-commerce, add to bag, and there we go. It was so much fun.
And now it's your turn. 3, 2, 1, look up at the camera. Great cover. 3, 2, 1. 3, 2, 1.
That's the essence of it. So obviously, it's a bit of fun. Note the opt-in option. You take your picture, you want it uploaded, you subscribe to their e-newsletter, and now they get your information, you get their information, and a 20% discount for having them take your picture. That's not bad. Customer interaction and a bit of fun at the store. So when we talk about retailing, I think we know the basics, right? Retailing is all activities related to the sale or rental of goods and services to you guys, the ultimate consumers, for your personal or family use. You're not buying it to make a profit. You're not buying it to improve the efficiency of your operation. You're buying it to enjoy for yourself. A retailer is a firm, a person, engaged primarily in retailing, primarily in selling or renting goods or services to you individually. Anybody's family involved in retailing? Anybody own a retail establishment by any chance? No? Okay. So, why do we have retailers? Retailers serve as purchasing agents for you, so you don't have to go out and contact a jillion different producers, which would not be practical. And as sales specialists for their suppliers, they don't have to figure out what's going on in every nook and cranny in the country. Retailers in those locations feedback information that, to them. We saw that when we talked about the various functions provided by channels of distribution. So they do this by helping to anticipate consumers' wants on the ground because they're there. They see what you're buying, what you're not buying, what you want. Developing an assortment of products. You want an array of clothing. You don't just want pants or socks. You want different things in the store. Acquiring market information to feed back to that supplier. And providing financing sometimes for the channel of distribution as they help hold inventory or sometimes for you if they allow you to buy and pay now and pay later. So these things all occur. So retailers offer the utilities, think back to about week one of our discussion together, of time, getting the good to you when you want it, place, getting the good to you where you want it, form, in the way that you want it, not a barrel of bolts. You want a few bolts, a few nuts, a few screws to do a home project, and help with the possession. They help transfer that title to you. All of these things are things we talked about way at the beginning of the semester that help talk about justification for marketing, yeah? So, time, place, form, and possession. It's pretty easy to become a retailer. Unlike in manufacturing, you don't have to have a huge investment in production equipment, right? That can be quite costly. Oftentimes, you can buy merchandise on credit. Again, if you think, I think we talked, how many people know Shark Tank? You've seen a No Shark Tank. Oftentimes, the person talking to the sharks talks about wanting to go to retail. And they often say, wait a minute, in retail, they take your product on credit, and when they don't sell it, they just ship it back to you. That's not a good way to go, is often what they say. Good for the retailer, good for the consumer, I guess, not necessarily good for the supplier, right? Store space can be leased in some cases with no down payment. And obviously, you know that a simple website can be set up fairly modestly. Who has a website where they're selling stuff already? Some people surely do. Nobody has a website? Oh, in the back there, you're selling stuff already successfully. Wasn't that expensive to do? And you have an audience online. Yay. But while it's easy to get into, that doesn't mean you're going to be successful. A successful retailer is a merchant who sells goods that won't come back, won't be returned, to consumers who will come back. Of course, a retail firm must also fulfill its other role of serving producers and wholesalers with the information. So this dual role is both the justification for retailing and the key to success in retailing. So providing information, goods, services successfully to those ultimate consumers. Who is really good at this? Well, let's take a look at the global powers of retailing this year. The first half of 2022 continued the positive pace set for the retail industry through 2021, according to Levin Management Corp's mid-year retail sentiment survey. At the same time, the commercial real estate service provider's annual poll results indicate a moderation in the expectations for the coming months. Nearly 71% of store managers say shopper traffic volume is at the same or a higher level year over year, marking the second highest percentage for this performance indicator in the survey's history. I do have a little problem when we keep talking about year over year comparing ourselves to one of the pandemic years, because the pandemic years were pretty low, and if you're returning at all towards normal, you get a big percentage jump year over year. The trade journals like to talk about the year over year increase. I'd like to know how we're doing compared to 2019 before there was a pandemic, but okay. The strong sales results are no surprise, mirroring anecdotal accounts from tenants within our management portfolio, as well as reports from industry sources. So these guys are not surprised at the increase compared to last year in retail. So from Deloitte, who are the big global powers in retailing? Perhaps no surprise, number one, Walmart in the US. They operate in 26 different countries. Amazon, obviously, 21 countries. Costco, number three, a cash and carry warehouse club, 12 countries. The Schwartz Group, which we may not know ourselves, out of Germany, operating in 33 countries. And rounding out the top five, the Home Depot, operating in three countries, and you can see the revenues there, followed up by Kroger, Walgreens, Aldi, JD.com, and Target. So those are the big folk. The report is 2022. The data is from 2020 because they didn't update it that fast. Backtracking just so you can see how it changed over time. Walmart, Amazon, Kroger, Costco, Walgreens, Home Depot, CVS, Target, Lowe's, and Albertsons from another source. Now, how much does it cost you to run a retail operation? It's going to vary a little bit, but your operating costs are about 28% of sales. So for every dollar you sell, your operating costs are about 28 cents. In the wholesale industry, that cost of operation is about 11%. Why do you suppose it's so much more expensive, more than twice as expensive, to operate a retail store compared to a warehouse operation? Why do you suppose it's so much more expensive?
Because wholesalers don't have to appeal to the final consumer. They don't have to have like fancy stores and staff that are highly knowledgeable when the customer
comes. 100%. So wholesalers, well, you've been to Costco or Sam's Club, they're a little bit towards retail, but they've got massive amounts stacked up on high shelves, not necessarily with the best decor, and certainly not necessarily with a lot of sales staff around to help you out. But retailers do need to have all those things. They need to deal with customers. They need to be appealing. They need to be friendly. They need to have stuff on display in nice ways. Meeting the customer expectations costs more money. And so it increases your operating costs compared to a place like a wholesaler, which is much less fancy. The net profits for retailers vary quite a bit. Supermarkets have a huge volume, but their profit is only about 1% of sales. How can you stay in business with profit of 1% of sales? Well, the answer is right there. Huge turnover, huge volume, bada bing, bada boom, bada boom. How often do you buy milk, bread, etc., over and over and over again? How often do you buy expensive jewelry? Not every week. Specialized retailers can earn 10% or more, but they don't have that rapid turnover. An average net after-tax profit for retailers, if you were to look it up, which I won't bother doing by clicking on the button, would be something like 2 to 3% of sales. Not massive net profits. Not massive. But obviously, there's a lot of retailers out there, and they're doing business. So they're happy with that 2 to 3% net profit. There are a lot of programs out there helping you to be sure that you are successful if you are a retailer. This software program called Retail Pro is going to help you keep track of all of these pieces and parts, all that information you need to have to be a successful retailer. Our latest retail management software, Retail Pro, marries retail, well, comprehensive features, modern architecture, improved flexibility, delivers outstanding agility, data security, accuracy, and operational control for specialty retailers with reduced hardware and technical support. And here's some of the areas that they operate in. And it's going to help you keep track of inventory and billing and invoices, etc. We can classify retailers in a variety of ways. Here we're going to classify them by ownership and marketing strategy. One type of retailer is an independent retailer. It's a single store, not affiliated with anybody else. That's most retailers, independent, which is why we have Small Business Saturdays. Go out and support the small businesses in your area. They're small. Oftentimes, compared to the big stores in your area, Walmart, Target, what you buy there is more expensive. But oftentimes, they offer a lot more services than do the big stores. Here is, anybody still going to Scribbles Coffee? Small, independent, all by themselves, but they're very friendly, they're knowledgeable, they know coffee, etc. So that would be a small, independent retailer. McKay Bricker does framing. You can go to your local Joanne store, Joanne Craft Store. Anybody ever been to Joanne store? Yeah, they have a lot of stuff, a lot of service. Can you get service easily in every department at a Joanne store? My wife would go like this. She says, no, you can't. Maybe over there by the cloth. And she stopped going to the framing because she didn't get enough help at the at that store. But, man, McKay Bricker, they're there to help you. A little more expensive, naturally, and a lot more service. It's really hard to compare the price of the two things because of the differences in merchandise and service. So it's really hard to compare the cost of the framing, say, between the two places. Many customers are willing to pay extras for the service that they consider valuable, such as perhaps the credit that they get, or delivery that they can have, or the alterations provided, the installation, liberal return policy, and of course, friendly, knowledgeable, personal service, depending on what you're looking for, can be a big factor in why you would go to a small independent store, small independent retailer. Also, of course, we have a series of stores owned by a corporation. So corporate chains are organizations of two or more centrally owned and centrally managed stores that generally handle the same line of products. Starbucks would be a corporate chain, yeah? Centrally owned, centrally operated, many, many, many Starbucks around selling essentially the same stuff. Joanne, I was just picking on Joanne, previously known as Joanne Fabric and Craft Store, is a corporate chain. Their marketing strategy. So Joanne has a fairly broad, relatively deep assortment of products. So you can get crafts and paints and stuff. I'm trying to think all they have. Decorations, framing, fabrics with moderate prices, level of personal service that does vary across departments. That's their strategy as a corporate chain. Three factors differentiate a chain from an independent store and the contractual form of a vertical marketing system. Size. The U.S. Bureau of Census considers 11 stores to be the minimum size for a chain. Anybody know Winking Lizard? I don't know. Do you know how many stores they have? I just ran into one in Columbus, which surprised me. I know they have a couple in Peninsula, so I don't know if they are big enough to be a chain or not. Yeah. Can't. So maybe they are big enough to have 11 stores and be a chain. I was just surprised to see them. I knew they were around here. I didn't know they were in Columbus. A corporate chain has central ownership and central authority. At our friends at Scribbles, man, they can sell whatever they want to sell. They can sell whatever kind of coffee they want to sell. They can sell whatever kind of pastries they want to sell. They can sell whatever kind of other beverage they want to sell. They own the shop. If you're managing a Starbucks, you can't suddenly decide to start carrying a different kind of coffee or a different, you know, muffin. You're doing what they're doing because you are under the central ownership and central authority. So that influences what you can do. So the individual units do not have a lot of autonomy when it comes to doing their marketing. About 40% of retail is owned by a central entity. Retail cooperatives are another interesting approach. They're a form of contractual vertical marketing system that are formed by small retailers. You're a small food store. You're a small hardware store. We talked about this problem before. How in the world are you going to compete against all the big boys? How in the world are you going to get out to all those producers that are out there providing products? You're a little guy in Twinsburg. How's that going to work? Well, the answer is it's not going to work very well if you're just by yourself. So instead, you put together a retail cooperative. You agree to establish and operate among yourselves, a bunch of retailers, a wholesale warehouse. And that wholesale warehouse then gives you the ability to advertise together and to, well, the agreement gives you the ability to advertise together, and the warehouse gives you economies of scale. Now you can go off to those big producers and say, hey, we aren't buying three of these things, we're buying 30,000 of these things, or 3,000, give me a price break. So this idea of a contractual vertical marketing system as a retailer cooperative is important for some small retailers to be able to compete in the larger marketplace and helps to get economies of scale. True Value Hardware is that. Ace Hardware is that. ShopRite grocery stores, retail cooperative. So these are all examples of folks that have gotten together and agreed to work together and run a wholesale warehouse. Flipping around, a voluntary chain is sponsored by a wholesaler. And that wholesaler enters into a contract with interested retailers. So retailer co-ops and voluntary chains differ in terms of who organizes them. Retailer co-ops organized by the retailer. Voluntary chains organized by the wholesaler. Both have been created for defensive reasons. That is to say, they allow independent retailers to compete with those larger, stronger chains out there. How are you competing with Target? How are you competing with Walmart? How are you competing with these other big chains? Get involved with a relationship with some other folk. IGA and SuperValu are voluntary chains organized by wholesalers. A contractual vertical marketing system includes the idea of franchises, where you have a continuing relationship in which a parent company, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Arby's, provides management assistance and the right to use its trademark in return for payments from the owner of individual business units. Anybody ever think it might be fun to be a run a franchise? Run a McDonald's, run a Taco Bell or whatever, Pizza Hut? Nope. So, not your cup of tea. But here we're going to have a formal contractual relationship with these folk. So again, they have a lot of control over what it is we do at a local franchise. The franchisor is the parent company, Taco Bell. The franchisee is the owner of that business unit in downtown Kent. And the franchise system is the combination of the franchisor and the franchisee. This type of contractual vertical marketing system generates about $1 trillion in annual sales and accounts for as much as 2/5 of total retail sales out in the big world. Who went to some franchisor during the holiday break? Who went to some fast food place? Okay, you're engaged in the franchise system. Subway, whatever time period I put that together, join the winning team with the number one franchise in the country. Register your interest. Subway, the number one restaurant chain in total restaurant count, with more locations than any other chain in the quick service restaurant industry. Here's the top franchises for last year. Taco Bell, the UPS store, Popeyes, Louisiana Kitchen, Jersey Mike's. They make a pretty good sub at Jersey Mike's. Anybody know Jersey Mike's? Pretty good sub. Culver's, I don't know them at all. Cumin, Planet Fitness, ServPro, 7-Eleven, and Tropical Smoothie Cafe. Top franchises if you're interested. And you can see that the retail investment, or the investment of the local owner varies quite a bit depending on where you are. So, for example, Taco Bell could be initial investment as low as $576,000 up to $3.4 million. Better turn over a lot of tacos if you're doing $3.4 million. So we're going to position ourselves in the marketplace against competition. What are some important dimensions we would think about in terms of how we're going to position ourselves from a marketing perspective? This example looks at the breadth of the product line. How many different sorts of things are you carrying, and the value added by your store. Anybody been to a designer shoe warehouse, DSW, ever? You've been there? Okay. I don't know if I'm talking to you anymore. You got me in trouble last time. So, if you, I'll talk to you anyhow. So, I'm going to go up here. So, at a designer shoe warehouse, what are you going to mostly find them selling? Designer shoes. And maybe you can get socks or shoelaces. Maybe. But you're not also going to get, you know, sweatpants, yoga pants, sweatshirts, et cetera, et cetera. And do they have a lot of staff there helping you out and trying things on and running around bringing you shoes? Probably not so much. So we would say that, in general, designer shoe warehouses has a narrow product line, mostly shoes, and not that much help. Compare that to, say, a Walmart. You can get anything in a Walmart, right? And so they're going to have a broad product line. You ever try to get help at a Walmart, though? Hard to find help. And so, again, low value added. Saks Fifth Avenue has a pretty broad product line, maybe not as broad as Walmart, but they have a pretty broad product line as a department store, yes, with some pretty good service. They're going to help you out selecting stuff, writing you a thank you note, telling you how good you did to buy from them, letting you know, for a while my daughter and wife were getting phone calls telling them that that new product that you might be interested in has just come in the shoe department, so you get that service. And finally, you have a company like Tiffany's, right? Tiffany's mostly jewelry, but you have a lot of value added by the sales staff in a Tiffany. So where are you going to position yourself along these dimensions? What we don't always think about as retailing is non-store retailing. So automatic vending machines are retailing. They are delivering products and services or rentals to you. Where is the closest non-store retailing to us right here? Right in the hallway. It'd be hard to set up a retail store in the hallway, right? Yet, it's easy for us to set up a vending machine there. So sales of products using a machine with no personal contact between the seller and the buyer. Certainly we're familiar with it for candy and soda and snacks. There we go. But who's been to an airport and seen some of the things you can buy in a vending machine at an airport? We used to say a long time ago, nobody's ever going to trust big dollars into a vending machine. I mean, you put in a quarter half the time, it doesn't work. You pull it, it doesn't come out. Who's going to trust big ticket items? What can you get in an airport vending machine? Electronics, Apple products, headphones. It takes your credit card and, you know, you're spending $100 or more in a vending machine. It's pretty amazing. Advantages, convenient. For the retailer, it offers expanded reach and it can be efficient. These machines, in the old days, you had to drive around your entire route and watch and see how the inventory looked in each machine. That took some effort. Now they'll tell you when their inventory is low because they have automatic reporting systems. They can be expensive to service. People beat up on them or the change thing isn't working. Can be expensive to send people around to stock. And then we keep changing our money or we change our credit card and we move to touch. So they're expensive to update all those machines as well. So advantages and disadvantages. What's new in vending? I don't know if this is as exciting every time I click on it. Let's see what they're saying is new in vending. Anything? More features. I was looking for some pictures, ATMs, kiosks, different kind of payments. It's not that exciting. Sometimes you get some interesting images of stuff as new vending. Music and game machines, jukeboxes, video games, pinball machines, kitty, okay, never mind. Cashless payment systems are relatively new with Apple Pay or Google Pay. Smartphone interaction with artificial intelligence. The vending machine gives your phone real-time inventories and options. I haven't seen that yet. Energy-saving vending machines to maximize product and productivity for the retailer. Facial recognition, the machine offers a personalized menu based on the purchase history of the consumer and prevents consumers from purchasing restricted products so that underage customers can't buy cigarettes or alcohol. And there's a pretty elaborate vending machine selling you fresh flowers if you need it, probably at an airport somewhere. So that's all retailing and expands that retailer's reach. How many of you guys know, how many of you guys have got something from Redbox? Isn't that a little amazing? We are still getting stuff from Redbox, which has been around for a long time. Where's the closest Redbox to us here? No, the Acme Plaza right down here. So anyhow, Redbox is America's destination for affordable and convenient new release movie and game rentals. About 1 million discs, and sometimes a whole lot more, are rented from their kiosks every day. That adds up to more than 5 billion rentals since they launched in 2002. My Big Fat Greek Wedding and Men in Black were hot, Men in Black 2 were hot rentals back then. Redbox is the best entertainment deal on the planet, and we should know, we're everywhere. We have more locations in the U.S. than Starbucks and McDonald's combined, so it's not hard to find us. You also find the lowest prices imaginable for today's biggest hits. I don't know if it's true today, but movie rentals for $1.75 a night, renting a new release movie from Redbox is half the cost of a new release cable movie rental, and we don't require a monthly subscription fee. Oh, yeah, I think there's also one down. Yeah. Oh, all right. So, obviously another form of retail I'm having too much fun with. Direct sales, direct selling, certainly fell off during the pandemic, but still a form of retail. Here we get personal contact between a salesperson and a consumer away from a store. That results in a sale. So door-to-door or in-house parties or in-office parties. So again, I think we asked this question maybe before. Anybody ever been to a Mary Kay home party? How about an Amway? Yeah, how about Shakely? Pampered Chef? Yeah, okay. So you've been to these things. What are the top 10 home party businesses? Avon, Pampered Chef, Scentsy, Mary Kay, Airbon, Amway, Princess House, Tupperware. I don't know what Stampin' Up! Is, and Paparazzi Accessories. The top 10 ways to get your product directly from your sales force to consumers in-home or in-office. Some people like it. So those of you who went, was it fun? Amusing? No comments. So they're convenient. People like personal contact with the sales rep. Anybody's aunts or grandmas still do Avon? Yeah? Okay, that sort of thing. They like that personal contact, perhaps. Disadvantages to the retailer is that keeping all those salespeople happy is expensive. So there's a high cost of commissions. And then a lot of people don't stay with it. So you have a high cost of recruiting these folks, training them, motivating them, retaining them. So there's some disadvantages too, but it's worked well. These companies we listed have been around for a long time using this direct selling approach. It's getting harder and harder to do telemarketing in the B2C world, right? Salesperson initiates a contact with the prospect, closes the sale of the phone. Still happens in the B2B world. Nobody answers their phone to a telemarketer anymore in the B2C world. But magazine subscriptions, credit cards, athletic club members, etc. Some people like the convenience, but there's a lot of rejection. Consumers run the risk of fraud. There are legal restrictions on this sort of activity. So that's getting to be a hard way to go in terms of retail, although still some companies can make that work. Anybody ever work in telemarketing by any chance? Sometimes you have people who've done that. Okay. Online retailing, well, you've heard of that. Firm uses the website to offer product for sale. E-commerce accounted for 16% of all retail purchases in 2019. Obviously, I have to update that. But it's bricks and mortar stores still are out there. They still exist. They're still doing business. But e-commerce keeps growing. Many new enterprises use this form of retailing. More than 45% of bricks and mortars have adopted it. Question? Go back a slide. There. And then I have to come up and bother you. And I know I bothered you before, but now I've forgotten. What it is that you're, what's your e-tail site? What are you selling?
I sell like clothes and stuff.
Clothing? Okay, and so do you make the stuff yourself? You source the stuff yourself? What's the clothing that you sell?
Yeah, it's like reselling, so I'll find stuff and then I'll sell it.
So you find stuff. Is it new stuff or you sell?
Depends. Like it could be something that I already had for a while or like I thrifted it and it's nice.
Cool. Very good. Yep. So e-tailing at work. 30% of direct-to-consumer brands say opening a store is a present priority. So we got the bricks and mortar folks getting interested in being online, doing e-tailing. But then e-tailers, 30% of them, are saying, maybe I should open up a bricks and mortar store. So we see this interesting switch back and forth as folks see what works best for their consumers and for their business model.
From Walmart.
This is from a while ago. Walmart, who's obviously pretty big, decides not to create their online presence by themselves. They acquire a company, Jet.com, given their efficiencies, knowledge, and customer base. So here's how they get involved.
Well, from a Walmart point of view, we're serious about e-commerce and want to serve customers in the way that they want to shop. And as we've been watching Jet.com grow, we've been paying close attention to the traction that they've had and their ability to scale so quickly. Then an opportunity to meet Mark and to hear more about how he thinks about retail, and we're like-minded in many ways, and that caused me to get even more excited about it.
Why isn't this something that Walmart.com could build itself? You've talked about how over the last fiscal year and this fiscal year, you're going to be spending $2 billion to invest in Walmart.com. That is some pretty significant resources. What did these people have that you need?
Yeah, well, in some ways, it's an and not an or. We've got a great team in California that's been making progress on e-commerce. We've talked before about the fact that we needed fulfillment centers. We needed an operating system. We have just gotten to the point now where marketplace is starting to scale in a different way. Mm-hmm. So we're on track there, and we're going to achieve high growth rates. But we have even higher expectations and higher standards about what we ultimately want to achieve. And the Jet brand adds to the Walmart portfolio. Around the world, we operate 74 different retail brand names. Outside the U.S., we have a lot of markets where we have different brands to serve customers. And Jet's customer profile, the brands they offer are accretive to Walmart, and there's some great skills. From a brand point of view, from a customer profile point of view, Jet's going to be additive to the Walmart offer. And there's some things about Jet.com from a design point of view, an offering to the customer from a price point of view that enables them to be even more empowered, and a smart cart and other technology that enable you to build a basket in a different way. So from a business point of view, basket economics are more attractive to us than unit economics, and that's one of the big things that attracted us to Jet.
So they spend $3.3 billion to buy Jet.com in an effort to take on Amazon in that bigger e-commerce space. And as he says, I love it when you come on my site and you didn't just buy one thing, but you buy a basket of things, and you know about adding things to your cart. Click, 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 buy it all. They like that approach. Direct marketing includes things like direct mail. You all get, I presume like we do, too much direct mail pieces that you probably throw away when you get them. Catalogs. Every time of the year, but this time of the year, I feel sorry for the poor mail delivery person, which is, although probably that's most of their revenue these days. My wife's catalogs on a daily basis look like this. I don't have any idea what these things are. Televised shopping. Again, aunts or grandmas still buy off of the home shopping network, off of television. Nobody's family members are still doing that. Some people love that, the excitement of it. There's only 3,000 of these left. Buy it before they all go away. So the home shopping network, QVC, HSN, the gem shopping network, all ways of getting product directly to the consumer without interacting with a salesperson per se. Direct marketing drawbacks, well, there's no product sampling. You look at the catalog, you look at the direct mail piece, and it's delayed buying and selling. Immediate gratification doesn't happen. It takes a while for it to get there. And so direct marketers certainly have to offer liberal return policies because people won't take the risk of the thing not being what they expect it to be. Direct marketing catalogs, direct mail, can be costly to create. They have to be created a long time in advance because they're fancy to get together in print. And obviously these things are hard to update, so you can get them out once a quarter or in some cases once a year. Some people find it to be convenient. Depending on what you're buying, it might be a relatively lower price than you can find otherwise. And certainly during the pandemic, safe social distancing was an appeal of buying through these direct marketing pieces. So if you are thinking about setting up a physical facility as a retailer, location is important. You've heard location, location, location. What location makes sense for you? How about the Central Business District? Here in Kent, what is the Central Business District? I don't know, Acorn Alley, right downtown in the exciting part of the heart of Kent. How about a regional shopping center that makes sense for you? How many of you guys have been out to Beechwood Place Mall? Yeah? So a lot of different things going on. It draws people from a broader area. They have anchor stores, Macy's, a community shopping center like the Stowe Kent Shopping Center here in, well, here in Kent. How about a strip location? I think, what's up there? I think there was a phone store up there. I think there's a buffet up there. What makes sense for you? How about a power center out at Macedonia Commons? A lot of different stores all located out there. So who's your consumer? What are they interested in? How much is it going to cost you in each of these places to set up shop? Yeah? Not everybody's happy going to the strip mall to buy their high-quality products. Also, we have the idea of size. What's the total square footage going to be, given what it is that you're selling? The store design, the style of your store, the appearance of the store, the signage of your store. I talked to a downtown retailer a while ago. The place had been another entity for a long time, and they spent a lot of time, even though I think it was still going to be a restaurant, redesigning the look. She said, when people walk into the store, if you don't change the look, the physical design, they'll just jump back to the feeling they had of the previous store. You need to make them feel as though it's different emotionally. Product layout, how you can allocate space to all your various products for it to make sense. And there are actually companies that help you to do that. Wholesalers might offer to do that for you, or suppliers might. Here's the anatomy of a store at the Kitson store in Santa Monica, California. The layout for the holiday shopping season is designed to lure shoppers in with quick hit gifts items that then guide them to more expensive fashions in the back of the store. So they have a nice window appeal to people coming in the store. Up front, they have those little gifts that you might want to pick up. If you have to stock up on items, that's near the front, and then they direct the flow of traffic. There's a transactional counter, and then high and low stuff is more towards the back of the store as you get people in and shift them down to see the higher price fashion. Makes sense for them. Stores do not get in one position and stay there forever. They change over time, at least many of them do, which gives rise to the idea of the wheel of retailing. Many, not all, stores start out with low prices, low margins, low status. But as time moves on, they get excited about offering new stuff, new services, new products, new things. So now that outlet has higher prices, higher margins, higher status, and that continues on. They get more excited about this. Still higher prices, still higher margins, and still higher status. But what takes the place of the original store that was successful? They aren't there anymore. It's an open gap. And so a new form of outlet enters the retailing environment that started where these guys were. The classic example of this is Sears and Roebuck. Imagine it's the end of the 19th century, and with one catalog, you can buy everything from beds and tools to clothing and opium. Yes, opium. Not to mention ear trumpets, horse buggies, and Bibles. The 1897 Sears and Roebuck catalog is a wonderfully fascinating collector's item and a valuable piece of American history. For every recognizable item, there are plenty of others guaranteed to confuse or interest 21st century readers, like bust cream or food and sweet spirits of nitre. What was once standard household fare is today a sometimes strange, often funny look at what life was once for like in the average American family. It's amazing to see that a princely shirt for princely men costs 95 cents or three for $2.75. Or that a complete violin outfit with bow case only costs $2. So Sears and Roebuck was originally a catalog thing going out all through America. And many outhouses, the Sears and Roebuck catalog was important for perhaps personal hygiene reasons. All right, but of course they moved away from being a catalog. They got out into the suburbs. They started building big Sears stores. Look at all that high fashion we got. We moved beyond catalog. Now we're going to get even fancier. Meet Kim Kardashian at Sears. We're moving up. We're getting more expensive. Things didn't work out too well as far as I know. Sears eventually crashed and burned, but we left lots of room for Target and Walmart to come in. Lower priced goods, right? So the wheel of retailing rotates around. So what are some institutional changes we're seeing in retailing? Well, a shakeout from overbuilding. There are too many of the same store. Starbucks periodically builds up. If the economy's good, they build them. And then suddenly the economy goes down. And you can't have five stores within one block radius. It doesn't make any sense. Adapting to consumer trends. You guys heard, I suppose, maybe about the last blockbuster store in the country that was finally closed somewhere out west. It was the last one. Blockbuster was the place to go in its day. Consumer trends change. We no longer do blockbusters. Bricks and clicks, we've already heard a bit about that. We have more websites for bricks and mortar stores and more electronic kiosks and shopping windows in bricks and mortar stores. So things change over time. What we say about this stuff is that these changes so far are evolutionary, not revolutionary. I don't know what the revolutionary change would be. I keep envisioning an environment where maybe one day we all have 3D printers in our home, and we buy the software for that new blouse, shirt, toy. We feed it into the 3D printer, and a while later we have our blouse, our toy, our shirt. That might be revolutionary, but it's not here anytime soon. So we'll see where that future comes from. So this was chapter 16, we'll plan on, but may not get to, chapter 17, implementing interactive and multi-channel marketing after we get to chapter 20, if we get there. So on Wednesday, we're going to move on to chapter 18, integrated marketing communications, the end. I did talk faster. Good job.